Good evening. My name is Doris Lill, and I'm the Senior Manager of Programs and Services at the National MS Society. Once again, on today's telelearning, Managing MS Bladder and Bowel Symptoms. Following the presentation, there will be time for question and answers, and we'll instruct you on how to ask your questions. Today's presentation is also being recorded and will be available on our website later this week. Let me introduce you briefly to today's presenters. Pat Kennedy has been working in the field of MS since 1987. Initially, she worked as a nurse practitioner in a large comprehensive MS center and then worked for CanDo MS as a nurse educator. She is certified as a multiple sclerosis nurse with extensive experience in bladder and bowel. Dr. Marlene Murphy is a urologist in Connecticut specializing in treating conditions affecting the urinary tract in men and women, including urogenic bladder, voiding dysfunction, and incontinence. She is the Director of Urology at the Mandel MS Center. Pat, I turn the call over to you. Thank you.
Well, good evening to all of you, and I'm glad that you took the time to listen to this particular webinar because I think there's lots of information that will be helpful for you. Next slide. I'm waiting. Okay. The reason that talking about bladder function and bowel function later, but the reason that it's so important is that such a large percentage of people with MS experience some kind of bladder dysfunction over the course of their disease. And it may be as high as 75 to 85% of folks with MS. It's not maybe all the time. It may be sometimes. But the problem is that some people still do not understand that this may be part of their MS picture and are not sure when they need to ask the questions that they need to ask. And as you all know, that having bladder difficulties can have a humongous impact on the quality of your life. Entire lives get kind of shut down when the bladder's not working correctly and you're kind of embarrassed by what's going on. I have found over time that as much as I deal with this, I figured everybody knows that bladder problems are part of MS, but they don't. And so one thing tonight is just to let you know, open up the floor and let you know that bladder issues are and can be a part of your disease. But secondly, if you're not aware that it is part of the disease, or if you're in your healthcare provider's office and you have difficulties, it's sometimes not comfortable to ask the questions of your healthcare provider. There may be an embarrassment issue. You're not sure if this is where you should ask the question. And so, therefore, the issues go undiscussed, and people continue to live with the problems that they're finding. So when you're looking at, okay, I have MS, I am having problems with my bladder, who do I talk to about that? And, you know, most of you are connected in some way with, certainly, I hope anyway, a family practice physician or provider, but also with a neurologist. But please understand that especially if you look at a neurologist, they may not all be as in tune to managing bladder difficulties as might be even a family practice physician who sees that more often, or someone like a urologist. So you need to find a provider who either understands bladder function or get hooked up with a provider who can deal with bladder issues. Also know that bladder problems happen in many disease states. So if you have MS and you're having bladder difficulties, it does not always mean that it's a part of your MS. It certainly could be something related to diabetes, or it could be related to prostate problems, or it could be related to gynecologic problems. So we can't make these assumptions just off the top that it must be MS. So keep that part in mind. This little graph or little cartoon that I have up here is just sort of a visual for you. And I want you to look on the left, and you'll see the picture of a brain and a spinal cord. And what I want you to understand is that even though your bladder is down in your abdomen, all the pieces that make that bladder function are in your brain, and they have to travel through nerves in your spinal cord and then through a nervous system that goes out to the bladder. So the reason that people with MS may have difficulty with their bladder function has to do with either lesions in the brain and lesions in the spinal cord. The other picture on the other side, if you can go back to that, good. If you look at this picture here, you have this balloon-looking picture here is a picture of the bladder, and it looks like a balloon. And that is called, just for tonight, that's called the detrusor muscle or the bladder muscle. At the bottom of the bladder muscle is where the bladder goes in through the urethra goes in through the base of the pelvis, and there are sphincters or valves, and those are valves that work to either keep the urine in the bladder and then allow the urine to get out of the bladder when it is socially appropriate. So I want you to see this picture so later when we talk about things, you'll have an idea of, well, that's how that relates. But definitely just remember that the bladder is sort of like a big balloon. It holds urine, and it will hold normally in a non-MS person. It will hold a certain amount of urine. And then as it gets fuller and fuller, messages will go to the brain and say, it's time to empty the bladder. The brain then has the capacity to say, okay, we can do that. And then it allows the messages to come back down to the bladder. And then it allows the bladder to contract or squeeze the urine out, and it allows the sphincters to open so the urine flows out. So in a normal bladder, that's how it works. With MS, there are some glitches, so we'll talk about those. Lesions in the brain and spinal cord, again, are responsible for the difficulties that you experience. Cord lesions, the spinal cord lesions, cause most of the problems that you might experience. But brain lesions also can cause difficulty with that voluntary control. That ability to say, I'm not near a toilet, hold on, may not be able to function. And so you may have difficulties at that point. And also understand that there is a correlation between physical disability level, your ability to function, especially when it's motor function and it's legs and both in movement and in sensation. When there's disability, then that increases your chances of having bladder difficulties. So why do we care? Why do you care? And why do we care? And the biggest reason, there are many reasons, but one, it's a huge one, are social reasons. And I mentioned earlier that when people have bladder problems, they may kind of isolate themselves, and they become kind of stuck in their home place because it's embarrassing to go out. It's hard to always know where the bathrooms are. It's sometimes hard to get to the bathroom even when you know where they are. So you tend to kind of hibernate in your house and not leave. Also involves self-esteem. You feel bad because if you have an accident, that's embarrassing. If you feel that there's an odor, that's embarrassing, and so we don't want that to happen. It certainly interferes with your quality of life. If you're stuck at home or you're nervous every time you go out, that's quality of life. And importantly also is that when people have bladder issues, there is a higher risk of urinary tract infections, both bladder and kidney. Kidney disease itself, and then the repercussions of pressures that develop in the bladder because of a bladder that isn't emptying well, will cause a difficulty in the bladder system, in the urinary system. So how do we diagnose bladder problems? Well, we really need a good history. And that comes from you. So when we're going to have this discussion with you, if you and I were in the office together, I would really want you to tell me as much as you can about how it is for you and when do you have the difficulties and what kind of difficulties are you having, et cetera. So even though we have technology today, a good history is where we really put so much of our concentration. We also want to check things like your urine and look for signs of infection, because signs of infection can give you urinary symptoms similar to MS. So we want to look at both looking for bacteria, but we also want to look at a culture and sensitivity so that we're really clear as to what's going on. We also don't want to forget that your urinary system can indicate other problems, and so we'll probably, if not us at the neurology office, but your family practice doctor or your gynecologist or your urologist will want to do a pelvic examination or a prostate examination, because difficulties in those areas can cause problems. We'll want to check and see when you do empty your bladder, are you emptying it or are you just letting off some of the urine, not all of it? A urologist will undoubtedly look at things like cystoscopy, and Marlene will explain that to a little more detail in a little bit, and also do urodynamic studies to look at how that bladder and the urinary system is functioning and where the difficulties may lie. So with MS, you have a failure to fill difficulty, and that's, I explained to you that if the bladder fills, then the brain eventually can send a message down and say it's time to empty. But that ability to inhibit that, to keep that bladder from emptying until it's time to empty, is sometimes lost. And when that takes over, then what happens is people experience symptoms, and they will experience things like frequency of urination, anywhere from every 15 minutes to, more frequent, less frequent, but still more frequent than you're used to. They will experience things like urgency, I gotta go, and I gotta go now. Incontinence, and usually that's the kind of loss of urine where I have to go and then you dribble some on the way to the bathroom. But typically we don't see a huge history of urinary tract infections. So how do we manage that? Well, there are many things we can do, and we certainly want to measure and see how well you do empty your bladder when you do go. And, of course, you can do that through ultrasound. We can do that through catheterization just for measurement purposes, just to find out when you're going, whether it's frequently or not frequently, are you emptying? And that's what we really want to know. Management through behavioral modification, and people can learn how to void more efficiently and change the way that they're voiding so that they're able to catch that bladder before it becomes a sort of have-to moment. There are things like pelvic floor physical therapy that people are trying to manage their bladders with, and that can be successful for some people. Fluid management, and lots of patients with MS, when I say that, will say, well, of course I do that all the time. I just don't drink. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about drinking, but drinking it on a schedule. And it's drinking so you take your fluids in when you're able to get to the bathroom afterwards, versus if you're going to a two-hour movie, don't drink a big Coke before you go in, because then you're going to have to get up and leave the movie. So you can learn how to manage your fluids. Dietary changes to avoid irritating foods, and there are a list of things people can experiment, but certainly things like Equal, sometimes people find tomatoes are irritating to their bladder, beer, alcohol, all of those things can cause increased urination. Medications that will help to shut down that urge from the bladder muscle to squeeze and empty. So there are medications, and I think Marlene will be talking about that. Botox injections, again, stimulators that work with the sphincters that allow the urine out. And some physicians are still using DDAVP, which is a medication that actually functions with the kidneys to try to cut down the amount of urine that's made, but it's not meant to be used on a long-term basis. If you have a bladder that doesn't empty well, that may be, again, a spinal lesion, and this may create such things as the bladder muscle may squeeze when it feels the need to, but the sphincter sphincters may not open completely. And so some urine comes out, but not all, and then the sphincter shuts. And so all the urine has not emptied out of the bladder. There can also be incomplete sphincter relaxation. So a person may be able to void and have urine come out, but it never quite stays open long enough for all the urine to come out. And then there can be a sphincter paralysis, which is the sphincter itself it will not open at all, or then there are some people who have a sphincter which stays open all the time. So what are the symptoms of this kind of bladder? Well, their frequency, now doesn't that sound familiar? Same symptoms as the other kind, the failure to fill. Urgency, urge incontinence with urine loss. Hesitancy, I really have to go, I really have to go, I really have to go, and then you get in there, and then you're not able to go, and that's that sphincter not working even though the bladder wants to empty. Some people say they don't feel empty. They go, they leave, and they think, okay, I've gone, and then they say, oh, I have to go again, because they're not really empty. Some people may experience a very slow stream compared to how they used to void. And we may see an increase in urinary tract infection. So we can't just go by the symptoms you present. That's why we need to have that really complete history and then further workup so we know exactly which kind of bladder you have. So if you have this failure to empty bladder, we have to look at how much urine is left in the bladder when you go. So if you go and go and go and you're done, you think, and then we measure and we find an amount of urine that exceeds what is expected, then we have to start working on teaching double voiding, where people can void twice or three times to get their bladder empty, timing themselves, managing fluids, just as with the other type of bladder. There are some medications that may be helpful in relaxing the bladder sphincter. Not helpful for all, but helpful for some. If, however, the amount of urine left in there is really high, that's an automatic ticket to go past go, as it were, and go to see the urologist, because then we need the urology expertise to be able to help us find out exactly where the glitch is in your urinary system. And Marlene will talk further about that, about what some of those treatments are. So a urology consult, I've over the years, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of patients. And, nobody says, oh, goody, I've always wanted to do that. But what we really try to tell them is this is the best route to go to find out how we can best manage your bladder, how we can decrease those urinary tract infections, how we can rule out, is this some other concurrent disease? Is this something else you have going on besides your MS? And sometimes in MS offices, neurology offices, they don't have all the gizmos there like ultrasound to be able to measure and see how much urine is left in your bladder. So we would send you to a urologist for that. And with that, I'm going to turn this now over to Marlene, who's going to give a urology point of view.
Thanks, Pat. I think that was a wonderful overview of how the physiology of the bladder and the pelvic floor work. And really, I think the take-home message that both of us hope that you walk away from is that your bladder is a very important symptom, potentially, of your MS, and it is a symptom that has often been overlooked, under-evaluated, and under-treated. And I, in particular, as a urologist, have taken a special interest in this. Now, a urologist is a surgeon who takes care of the urinary tract in both males and females, and the genital of a male in particular. A urologist should have the skills to test and manage your urinary tract as related to neurologic diseases and understand the significant impact that it potentially can have on your kidney function. However, I'm going to stop there and say that there is a subspecialty called neurourology or urodynamics, in which urologists have sort of self-selected an interest in taking care of patients with MS or spinal cord injuries or other neurologic insults. And I think it's important to identify that type of a urologist in particular who will really understand what's going on. We also treat urinary tract infections, general incontinence, and stones. So as Pat already alluded to, it's well understood that if your overall neurologic function is improved, we do hope that your voiding dysfunction will also improve. And one of the nice things about being in a multidisciplinary center is that we're able to work very closely with neurology, physiatry, the rehab doctors, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and then a urologist, so that I can work with all of my colleagues, because we understand that if we can get you to the bathroom faster, your mobility is improved, the likelihood of you having an incontinence episode goes down. And likely, more likely, if I fix your incontinence and make you stop having to rush to the bathroom, I'm going to diminish the likelihood that you might fall or hurt yourself. Now, in particular, I love MS patients because the treatment must be individualized. I need to, as Pat said, take a very thorough history that pertains to you, your mobility status, your dexterity, how well do your hands work, if there's any cognitive dysfunction, if you do need assistance from a care provider, is that person available and when? I need to know exactly what your symptoms are. What is bothering you the most about your bladder or your bowels? What are your expectations? Do you want to be totally dry at any cost, or do you want to just be improved? I then will do urodynamic testing, which I think I talk about on another slide, but if not, I'll cover it on this one. And then I obviously have to go through what the potential side effects of any medications or therapeutic interventions might be. And the important thing that I try to stress is that I'm not just the bearer of bad news. I obtain a lot of information. We do some very interesting testing. And then there's typically, I would say 99% of the time, I have a solution for every problem thrown my way. It is very important that you have at least a kidney ultrasound. As Pat mentioned, the bladder needs to hold, and it needs to hold at pressures below a certain measurable amount, okay? So just like we know your blood pressure can damage your heart, people with neurologic disabilities will develop pressure changes inside the bladder that can impact their kidneys. And the urodynamic testing is a bladder function test that allows me to determine whether or not your bladder pressures are safe. It also allows me to determine whether you're having a problem with failure to fill, with storage, or with a problem with failure to emptying. And is it a weak bladder? Is it an overactive bladder? Is it a sphincter problem, a gait problem like Pat alluded to, where your pelvic floor and your bladder are not working the way they should be? So by doing this test, I actually get real data, kind of like an EKG. So I can tell what's going on with the muscles and the pelvic floor, and I can interpret it to determine that you're safe, that your kidneys are not going to be at risk of having any back pressure over time, and I can also figure out the intervention that's needed and tailored specifically to you and your urologic issues. Next slide. So as we already talked about, behavioral modifications would be the first approach that I might take depending on the bladder testing. So when I do the urodynamics, really the question I want to know is, are you safe or not? And when I refer to safe, it's that storage pressure. I want to know that when you are walking around holding urine in your bladder, that your bladder is holding at a pressure that's safe for your kidneys long term. And that's really my primary goal. My secondary goal is to improve your quality of life. And third is to prevent infections and other complications, kidney stones and so forth. So depending if your bladder's safe and you have mild to moderate incontinence and it's really not affecting your quality of life but like to improve it, then the first thing we would do is try some behavioral modification. So we could try to retrain the bladder. You just tell it to wait a few minutes, and every day you try to increase the intervals between urinations. As Pat alluded to, timed voiding is great. This is if you have mobility issues and you know your bladder's quick on the trigger, then you want to beat it to the punch. So I always make a terrible joke that MS makes your legs slow and your bladder fast. It's a bad combination. So timed voiding is a really good way of tricking your MS. Prompted voiding would be used if you're having some memory issues or cognitive dysfunction. It's important for the person hanging out with you to sort of gently remind you, or you could wear a watch and set the timer because we all get busy and we don't remember when the last time is that we urinated and you don't want to be caught off guard. And I really, really, really don't like absorbent pads and undergarments, but if you're going to go out, if it means putting a pad on so you have a safety net, then by all means do so, but just change them frequently and keep yourself clean. So if you have a bladder that doesn't empty, you can learn clean intermittent catheterization. So this is the bladder that sits in hold mode or doesn't completely empty because the pelvic floor isn't relaxing when it's time to urinate. So we would teach you either to pass a small straw, perhaps every time you feel the need to void, or maybe just a couple times a day to get that extra out, because if you don't get that extra out, you're going to get a urinary tract infection. So patients always think, if I pass that straw, I'm going to get an infection. It's actually the opposite. If you let that urine sit in there, it becomes like a stagnant body of water, and it gets yucky. So you want to get it out. Not a fan, if I can help it, of indwelling catheters, particularly Foleys. Now, those are the ones that go in through your urethra, and they drain your bladder. Those will destroy your urethra. So they will start to erode and make your urethra a big, old, gaping hole, rendering you totally incontinent and creating a lot of surgical trouble for both of us. Suprapubic tubes are a more suitable option for patients who have significantly impaired mobility, lack manual dexterity, particularly females where transferring to have to catheter is quite tedious and time-consuming. We often might put a suprapubic tube in. Sometimes we can cut the sphincter, so that pelvic floor that Pat talked about that doesn't want to relax. We can either inject Botox into it to keep it in the locked open position or cut it, and then a external catheter can go on a male. And again, I really try to stay away from any type of indwelling catheter because of the reasons that are outlined there, and particularly the risk for malignancy long term. But again, I have to take every patient case by case and weigh risks and benefits. So there is an increasing role for biofeedback now in the United States. It was developed by Dr. Kegel. These are those exercises that every pregnant woman is taught. We usually have been using them for patients with stress incontinence, either females after childbirth or gentlemen after prostate cancer removal. There have been a number of studies done in Europe that have shown that the biofeedback is actually effective in the treatment of MS patients with, 40 to 60% improvement in their symptoms. It decreases your bladder overactivity. It can increase your pelvic floor strength. And it is a non-invasive form of physical therapy. So it basically involves placing a small probe or external electrodes, like sticky pads, down near the gate, down near your pelvic floor. You're connected to a computer monitor, and when you squeeze your pelvic floor, you're able to see on the computer monitor that you're generating the right muscle. So you're getting visual stimulation or feedback about how well you're controlling your pelvic floor, and it has been shown to be a nice, non-invasive first-line therapy. So, as Pat alluded to, the majority of patients with MS will have urge incontinence. So when you got to go, you got to go, and you've got to go right now. And the mainstay, the primary class of medications for overactive bladder, I'm sure you all know because they're advertised all over the TVs, but they're called anticholinergics or antimuscarinics. And basically they tell the receptors in the bladder to kind of chill out, to just relax, and they increase the amount of warning that you have in order to get to the bathroom. These medications are listed below. They all are name brand medications, all out on the market. They are all what are considered long-acting medications, so they're given once a day. And by doing this, it obviously makes it easier for you to take, and we're trying to minimize side effects. Now, the problem with these medications is that the same receptors that they're working on in the bladder are also located in the brain, the eye, the mouth, and the gut. So common side effects are confusion, dry eyes, dry mouth, and constipation. And I know that you guys are all sighing and moaning because these are already symptoms that some of you are experiencing. Now, over the past several years, a new class of medication, a standalone drug called Mirbetric, has come out. And this actually works on different receptors in the bladder that help you hold better. So it's a very subtle difference, but it's working on what are called the beta receptors. So they tell the bladder to stay in the hold mode, and it kind of closes that gate. So it's helping you hold, closing the gate, and you're getting to the bathroom on time. Now, the only contraindication or the reason why you wouldn't be able to take this is a medication called Atenolol, which is a very common beta blocker. So that is the one medication that if you're taking, and there is a slight risk of rising your blood pressure, so I do ask that patients check their blood pressure weekly and, you know, report back to me. But this does not have those other side effects of dry mouth, dry eyes, and constipation, and has been a welcome addition to the medications I have available to you. A posterior tibial nerve stimulation, we're really not sure how this works, but it's another sort of stimulation or activation of alternative pathways to your bladder. So again, as Pat talked about, we need communication between the brain and the bladder to be intact and to have that signaling go back and forth like a fiber optic cable. Sometimes your bladder, so if that communication is not getting from point A to point B appropriately, we can teach it new pathways. That's the theory behind the biofeedback, and that's the theory behind posterior tibial nerve stimulation. This is an office-based procedure. It works very well for urgency, frequency, and urge incontinence. You would come into the office, and down near your ankle bone is where your posterior tibial nerve is located. A very small wire, like an acupuncture needle, would be placed. You sit in a chair, and stimulation of these reflexive pathways are being delivered to your bladder and sort of help retrain the bladder, tell the bladder to quiet down and to minimize the urgency and urge incontinence. And obviously this can be combined with, you know, other therapies as well. Next slide. So when all else fails and I run out of all the conservative things, the next things I talk about involve some type of surgical intervention. Botox, most of you are familiar with. It was FDA approved for the neurogenic bladder in 2011. And I actually started injecting in 2009 and have 6 years of experience doing so. The bladder augmentation surgery, I'll show some pictures of on the next couple slides, and then ultimately urinary diversion. So the Botox has been a wonderful addition to my armamentarium because it is reversible and it doesn't involve major surgery. So if you fail medical therapy, so this would be for the patient who has failure to fill, failure to store. If you have urgency, urge incontinence, frequency, getting up at night. If you failed medication or the side effects are just intolerable, dry mouth, dry eyes, constipation, then this would be a nice treatment option for you. So the treatment involves injecting into the bladder through the urethra with a small telescope. It can be done in the office or under a tiny bit of sedation in the operating room. And basically, it is injected into those muscle fibers that are preventing your bladder from having the elasticity of the balloon-like state that Pat referred to, and quieting those muscle fibers down to prevent them from being so spastic. What's important for patients to know is that Botox needs to be coordinated if it's going to be injected into other sites. So if you're getting it injected for migraines, for facial pain, for extremity spasticity, it needs to be a same-day injection or separated by 3 months in time due to antibody formation. So it's just really important if you go to see a urologist or you go to see a physiatrist or your neurologist that you mention to them that you're receiving Botox from another physician. Next slide. Augmentation cystoplasty. So I have a picture of this. So in essence, the goal of this is to improve your elasticity. So again, my primary goal is to make sure that no one with MS ever dies from kidney failure. And if your bladder has become so small, so thickened, with such pressure that's going to damage your kidneys, and I can't make it better any other way with medication, with Botox, then I have one of two surgical options. The first here is the augmentation cystoplasty, which is a very fancy word for me, making your bladder bigger surgically. It's very important when you have this type of procedure, and the next slide will show it, that you have the dexterity to be able to catheterize. What this does is it keeps you in permanent hold mode. So you will hold and fill quite well. You will never empty again. So you need to learn to pass the little straw either through the urethra or through a small opening that I make in your tummy that leads to this new, bigger bladder. So the next slide shows basically the bladder. So this little tiny shriveled up bladder, I cut it in half and open it. And then the next slide shows a piece of small intestine that is taken away from the rest of the small intestine. Your intestines are left intact, so you move your bowels normally. But I take that piece of bowel, and I take it from its ziti, so it looks like a ziti normally, like a tube, and I make it flat and then fold it on itself and then make a new pouch on top of the bladder. So I've augmented your bladder. I've given you 2 to 3 times the bladder capacity that you need, and this will give you safe storage pressures. So we don't worry about your kidneys, but again, you do need to learn how to pass that little straw. Next slide. And my final slide is to just talk about a urinary diversion, and honestly, this is when I've determined, when you and I have determined as a team that you can't live with your bladder anymore, and your bladder is controlling your life or it's putting you at risk for kidney failure. And in this procedure, this is a passive procedure for the patient long-term. It does not require any catheterization. We take the piece of small intestine again, and then the next slide shows that the kidneys are then plugged into this conduit, this piece of small bowel, and it's brought out through the skin as a stoma. And everything, when patients hear stoma, they immediately think of colostomies, and they start to become nervous. What's nice about an ileal conduit is that it's very quiet. No one knows it's there. You don't have to worry about passing gas or having an accident. And it's very user-friendly and gives patients significant amount of independence. So this is obviously something that I spend a lot of time counseling patients about, and we make this decision together as a team because this is not reversible. So lastly, urinary tract infections. Urinary tract symptoms and infections are very common. Unfortunately, a lot of the medications that are out there for MS, Gilenya, Tysabri, Ampira, some of their side effects are urinary tract infections. So I think it is really important, again, to be hooked into a urologist even if at the present moment your bladder is behaving, you still are at risk of urinary tract infection, and it's nice to have someone on board who can manage that for you. We also don't want to have those urinary tract infections go up to the kidneys, as Pat alluded to, where you get a kidney infection, because then you can develop scarring on your kidneys, and that's irreversible damage. Again, what's important in the take-home is when you talk to me or another urologist who has an interest in MS, what you tell me may not be an accurate indicator of your bladder function. So for me to know what to do in your best interest, I have to do the bladder function test, and you need at least a yearly ultrasound. And that concludes my part. I'm going to pass it back to Pat.
Okay, thank you so much. And I want to take the last few minutes that we have together here for this part of the presentation to talk about bowel dysfunction. And bowel dysfunction from a neurologic perspective is not so dissimilar from bladder in that the same messages from the brain and the spinal cord are controlling also how your bowel functions and various things that you would normally expect your bowel to do may not be working as well. So it's very appropriate for us to discuss this at this time. So when you have MS, what kinds of things can you expect from your bowel? Well, I think what we hear mostly, and I think a lot of you can concur with this, is constipation. And constipation is a slow bowel. This is waste that moves through the bowels quite slowly. This can be as a result of the nervous system. It can be as a result of the medications that you take. It can be a result of the fact that you're not as mobile or able to move around as you once were. You're sitting more than you used to. You may not be eating as appropriately as you once did. All these things can contribute to constipation. So we do see a great deal of this. Diarrhea itself is not so much caused neurologically. It's not caused by the MS. But the difficulty with diarrhea is that that's a fast bowel, and your bowel content may be very loose, and it's coming through the bowel quite quickly, and your ability with your sphincters, just like not the same sphincters as the bladder, but sphincters at the end, the ability of that sphincter to hold that stool inside your bowel until you can get to the toilet is diminished. And so people who do develop diarrhea from any number of reasons may have difficulty with diarrheal stools. And then there are involuntary bowel problems, which are you may not realize that you have to actually move your bowels, and the stool that is in your gut wants to be let out, and the sphincters have a relaxation phase, the muscles in the intestines move that waste through, and you're all of a sudden emptying your bowel at a time when you really hadn't planned to, and it's quite embarrassing, it's quite difficult to manage. So how do you improve this? Well, we said one of the reasons you can have problems is you're not moving as much. So one of the ways you can improve this is to move your body more. And whether that's in a formal exercise program, a milder exercise program, moving around in a wheelchair even, will help to get that movement going, especially in that lower gut. We need you to eat regularly, and that's 3 meals or 6 meals a day, however you plan your daily food intake, and pay attention to making sure that you include high fiber foods in that diet that you eat throughout the day. Increase your fluids. Now, you know, we just talked about that, and we say how difficult it is when you take in fluids and your bladder's not working well. Well, I would suggest that, you know, we try to get your bladder in working well and then increase your fluids, but whatever. The difficulty is when you don't drink enough fluids, then you don't have enough fluid in your gut. Your stool becomes very hard. The harder it is, the more difficult it is to pass, and then it begins to block up in your gut. And so that causes the constipation. So we need to be able to give fluid into the gut so that you're able to empty the gut in a more healthy way. And we want you to establish a bowel program. You know, throughout your life, since you were toilet trained when you were 2 or 3, you don't have to think about it. You go when you go, and you just, oh, I have to go, and I'll go. but sometimes when you develop a neurologic problem and other diseases as well, that ability to pick up on those cues and to be able to get into the bathroom and empty that on a regular basis is gone. And so we want you to begin to think about, okay, let's establish a bowel program. So it's sort of like taking you back a little bit to the 2- and 3-year-old and develop a bowel program that is a bit like toilet training, which you can do. And that basically you establish a schedule, and whether that's on an everyday basis, twice a day, every 2 days, every 3 days. What I hate to hear is my patients tell me that they go every 7 to 10 days. That is not healthy. We need to have those wastes removed from your gut on a regular basis. So you need to set up this daily schedule. You choose a time of day that works best for you. Morning is best for most people's bodies, but not everybody's, but morning is when your gut begins to do its own normal movement, and that will help your gut to be able to move the waste through it. But some people, their bowel time may be in the afternoon or in the evening, and that isn't crucial. It's just that you need to pick a time of day that you can stick with. So as I once told a patient, she had always picked 10 a.m. as her time, and that was fine, except that she went to church on Sunday. And guess where she was at 10 a.m. on Sunday? So I suggested that we maybe needed to find another time, or she needed to give up church, and I didn't think that was a good idea. When you're trying to set up this time, you need to sit on the toilet on your scheduled time. Now, that doesn't mean you sit there for 2 hours until your bowel moves, but you sit there because that gives cues to your nervous system. So that your nervous system says, oh, that's what we're supposed to be doing, even though you don't necessarily feel the need to do that. And initially, it may not work well. It may take you several weeks, 6 weeks, before things begin to kick in and you begin to get that normal pattern set. But don't want you ever to sit on the toilet longer than 15 minutes, which means that in the very beginning, you're going to have some difficulty with all of that. If your stool is really, really hard, not enough fluids, stool's been sitting there too long, it gets drier and drier, it's okay to add a bulk agent, Metamucil, for instance, and I know that's a brand name, but a bulk agent like Metamucil or Fibercon or one of those, and importantly, increase your water and fiber at the same time. If you take a bulk agent and don't increase your water, it works a little bit like cement. So you want to make sure if you're taking a bulk agent that you're also chasing it with water so that it keeps that stool moist and easy to pass. To get that stool moving, sometimes you have to stimulate the rectum, and that may be using your finger with a glove on it to put it inside your rectum and tell the rectum that, hey, this is the time we're going to be doing this bowel thing, and that will stimulate sometimes the bowel to empty. And also using things like glycerin suppositories over the counter and put into the rectum, they will stimulate the very end part of the rectum and help to get that stool out. Utilize foods. Go the natural route. Things like prunes, oatmeal, fruit, whole grains. Be looking at those fiber contents, but sometimes those are all you need, and then things will kind of come into line and be better for you. And allow a few weeks for this program to work well. And finally, okay, so we apparently are ready for questions and answers.
We are. Thank you so much, Pat. Okay, operator, we're ready for questions. For those of you using the chat feature, I have been monitoring your questions and we'll work them in. Those of you on the phone, the operator will assist you with asking your questions. And operator, what is it that they press to ask their questions?
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register for a phone question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you'd like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. One moment, please, for the first phone question.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and start with a couple of the online ones. The first question from Mike, are all bladders the same size?
So, yes, inherently everyone you're all born with a certain bladder capacity, and so the average person can hold about a half of a liter, which is about the size of a soda can. And then, unfortunately, due to neurologic insults, radiation, chronic infection, you can get stiffening or shrinking of the bladder. So, yes, everybody is born with the potential for the same bladder capacity.
Okay. Another online question from Sue. Which area of the spinal cord typically causes urinary or bowel issues?
Well, actually, there are many areas because your spinal cord is a bit like a major phone line, and there are a million wires that go up and down that cord going to different parts of your body to tell it to do different things. And so it isn't that there's so much a spot in your spinal cord, but it's more that that passage of messages throughout the spinal cord is not being effective.
And that's a very, I just want to add real quick, is so the communication center, the command center is at the base of your brain, and the final
mm-hmm.
nerves are down in your pelvis, in your sacrum. But as Pat said, it's a giant fiber optic cable, and anywhere along the way, if that signal is short-circuited, you will develop a bladder dysfunction. And that's where the fascinating part of it comes in for me, because I cannot tell by just talking to you what your urodynamic pattern is going to be. And so you may have a friend who has the same lesion, the same level, and no bladder dysfunction, but you do. And so you can't really predict or base it on your level versus someone with a spinal cord injury where it's a complete transection of that fiber optic cable. That's a different – then I could comment on what type of bladder you're going to have based on the level of the spinal cord that's been damaged, but that's a complete disconnection. I've pulled the plug. You guys have patchy patchy areas, obviously. So incomplete messaging.
Okay, great. Another question from Chad. Can you comment on the use of InterStim bladder control therapy for incontinence?
So I have not gotten into InterStim because they are not MRI compatible. And so it limits the ability of you to have MRIs. So most of my patients don't want to have it placed. But InterStim is another way of tricking. So InterStim is a nerve stimulator. It's like a pacemaker for the bladder. It's a surgical implant that essentially will quiet down an overactive bladder and will sometimes help a bladder that's sluggish to be more assertive and empty well. However, the devices themselves are not compatible with an MRI.
Okay, great. Thank you. Operator, a phone question?
Yes, our first phone question comes from the line of Ellen. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, hi. I had two really quick questions. The first one is, I was having urinary tract infections like two or three times a year, and it was always coming back as, like, bacteria, E. coli.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking cranberry tablets, like everybody said, and it didn't seem to do much. But I started taking, it was recommended, D-mannose. Have you heard of that? Do you have any opinions on if that's a good thing to take? Because it seems to be making quite a good difference for me.
So there's no clinical trials that show that D-mannose, you know, is highly effective. However, it does work in a similar way as cranberry pills in that it makes the bladder lining slipperier and harder for the bugs, the E. coli, to attach. I just want to say that fewer than four infections in a calendar year is not something to get panicked about. I know they're awful. My patients hate them. I've had them. I know you're miserable. But from a urologic standpoint, as long as you have four or fewer in a calendar year, you're safe.
Okay.
And I'm okay with you taking D-mannose if it works.
Yeah, I have had none in a year from
taking
D-mannose.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
For you.
No risk there, okay.
No.
And then
nope.
And the second thing is if a bladder doesn't empty all the way and I'm not mobile, I can't walk at all, and if I go, like you said, it'll come out but not all of it, is there danger? Because what's happening is if I cough or push on my stomach, I can make more come out. Is that a risky thing to do too, or is that okay if it works?
Pat,
you want to get that, Marlene? Or
it depends on how hard it would be for you to pass the straw. If you can cough and do something where you're increasing your abdominal pressure mildly, I'm okay with it. But that's probably the risk factor for your recurrent infection. So I would if you were my patient, I would make sure that I saw you several times a year to make sure that the amount that you're retaining isn't increasing, because at some point it will become a problem.
Okay.
And if I could just add to that, if you remember that picture of the bladder, and if it's not empty and you have, you know, that half a soda can full still left in there, if you press really hard, while you may be able to press out some of that urine, a lot of that pressure is going up into your kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
So that pressure that Marlene was talking about is the really dangerous part, and so that probably isn't the best thing to do on the long term.
Okay, well, thank you very much. This call's been great. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Another phone question, Mark?
Yes, our next phone question comes on the line of Sue. Please proceed with your question.
Got a quick question. Is there something, because I'm now secondary progressive, and it's like I don't want surgeries or anything. It's like I've had bladder problems and bowel, you know,
mm-hmm.
for years. And it's like, okay, it's getting worse. And then it's like the frequency, the urgency, where sometimes it's like, I don't know if I have to go, if I do have to go. It's like, oh, boy, I guess I do. Because all of a sudden I stand up and, oh, my gosh.
Have you been evaluated by a urologist?
No.
Okay.
And I don't know if there's anybody here in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yes, there are.
Okay. That's where it's at.
Ask your neurologist.
Who you speak to.
Yeah, ask your neurologist for a referral. But I do know that Omaha does have urologists who deal with your urologic difficulties.
Okay, you know, because some they don't know enough about.
Mm-hmm.
I always wonder with MS, and I've gone through different primary care doctors, and it's like they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
But I like my neurologist.
Good.
He knows me.
He'll know a good urologist for you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Okay. There are a lot of questions on the chat feature about catheterization. So, I don't know, can you give us a reader's digest on pros and cons, and do I have to have a bag the whole time, and et cetera?
Pat, you want to do the catheterization?
I can start that, and then you can finish up. Catheterization is, you know, Marlene talked about it. She calls it a straw, and what she's referring to is it's a very short catheter for women. It's a very short catheter. It looks like a straw, and it's used intermittently. So a person can insert the catheter through the urethra into the bladder, empty the urine out, take out the catheter, and cleanse it or discard it, whatever you do. And it depends on whether you do it once a day or five times a day or more, whatever works best to keep that bladder empty. And then there are the catheters that are the indwelling catheters, the Foley catheter, which Marlene said is not her favorite to use, nor mine, but sometimes there is a necessity for that. And then there are the kinds of catheters, suprapubic, where a little incision is made on top of the bladder, and the catheter is permanently, not permanently, but inserted in there, and then it gets changed on a regular basis.
No, that's right.
That's it.
So I tell patients it's a permanent but reversible solution. So if they have if you're having a bad relapse and you can't manually pass the catheter anymore and you need a respite, we can put a suprapubic tube in, and when you're done with it, we pull it out and the hole closes. So it's not anything irreversible. But our preference is always to have you pass that tube intermittently. and empty the bladder rather than having something chronically in there that's going to cause infection and stones and bleeding.
Patients always ask that, you know, won't I have more infections if I use, let's say, intermittent catheterization? And, in fact, that's the whole reason intermittent cath was sort of developed was, I think it was World War II, there were so many urinary tract infections from soldiers that were having problems, and then they developed this way of doing it, and, oh, the amount of infections went just dropped, just plummeted. So, in fact, people who catheterize actually experience way less, if any, of urinary tract infections.
Okay. Mark, another question from the phone line?
Yes, our next phone question comes from the line of Diane. Please proceed with your question.
Hi there. I really enjoyed this presentation. I used to be one of those people that, like, was going to the bathroom four times an hour. I was completely paralyzed by incontinence. It was terrible. And it took me years to find somebody who actually did this kind of therapy, and I was so happy to find it. So I've been at RIC for, I think they call it women's therapy, for over a year, but with tremendous improvement, and I'm so grateful for it.
Is that a physical therapy? Is that what you're talking about?
It is, what, or you could call it bladder therapy. Or,
or pelvic floor therapy, yeah.
The expression is just women's therapy because it's so common. Many women have it, not necessarily.
Yeah.
It can be just age. So all in all, you know, I'm doing so much better, but I still have, I joke now that I have three bladders like a cow has four cows. Because I'll go, and then I'll wait, stand up. Okay, I'll go again. You know, not go anywhere, but, you know, stay there. Don't feel anything, stand up, and I'll go again. Almost every time. And so that, it sounds like that's just something that you can expect. Yes?
No, that sounds like what Pat alluded to in the beginning, that your pelvic floor and your bladder are not communicating and that your gait is not opening fully to allow your bladder to do one complete evacuation. It may be that you've been trained, your pelvic floor has been so trained that your sphincter now can't relax when it's time to urinate. So I would definitely not, again, I would, if you came to me with that symptom, I would want to have you urinate onto a special machine so that I could look at the pattern of your urination and look to see what's left behind. So that intermittency is a sign of dysfunction. So I think your pattern has shifted, and that's the other part about MS, is that you guys can be a moving target, and I never do something that's irreversible until you've proved to me that your MS has stopped moving. So your bladder pattern can be changing. So you might have had urgency, frequency, small bladder, spastic bladder, and it's now transitioned into a bladder that's a little bit sluggish with a pelvic floor that won't open. So I would get reassessed by a urologist or assessed by a urologist.
I've also found that, like, my diet has a huge effect, you know.
Yep,
if I go with, like, Dr. McDougall's starch solution diet, you know, I could just pee with, they say, something like a fire hose. You know, all of a sudden you have this tremendous ability to go in a big way, you know, like you're not, like, often I'm so hesitant or not, you know, and all that. If I eat the right foods, I'm so happy that I can, my flow is so much better. Do you know,
well, every case
you
is individualized,
that?
And I tell patients again that you have to do what's best for you, and what works for you.
Maybe people that are maybe a little bit hypersensitive to foods.
Well, I mean, you know, foods affect your bowels, affect your bladder, and it becomes this kind of vicious cycle. So it sounds like you're very in tune with your body, though, so that's really good. And
much
we're happy that you participated.
Was, definitely, yes.
Thank you.
And really kind of, you know, juggling between constipation and urinary problems, it's really like an orchestra you're conducting.
Yeah.
You know, you have to do everything.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It was a great presentation.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Okay.
Okay. And on that note, we're going to go ahead and close question and answers for today. I know that we didn't get to everybody's questions. I do have access to the chat record, and those of you who provided an email address, when you registered, you're going to get an email after the fact, and both Marlene and Pat have been gracious enough to say that they'll answer some questions via email. So you'll be receiving an email within the next few days with instructions on how to submit your question that way. So I want to thank you both for your time today. And before we formally end, I do have a couple of quick survey questions. So for those of you who are online, please answer the survey by clicking on the response in the center of your screen. So right now you should be seeing the first question, which is, are you a partner, family member, or person with MS? Please click in the center of your screen to answer the question. Okay. Moving on to the next question. Was the material presented this evening relevant to you? Yes or no? Please click the response in the center of your screen. Okay. Moving to the next question. Were the speakers and the information they presented easy to understand? Please click in the center of your screen with yes or no. Okay, and the last question, did you learn something new from this presentation? Yes or no? Please click your response in the center of your screen. Again, just a quick reminder that this presentation was recorded and will be available on our website for you to download the recording in addition to the actual PowerPoint presentation as a PDF that we showed this evening, and so that will be up within the next couple of days. You will also be receiving an email within the next few days with instructions on how to submit any questions that you would still like answered by Marlene or Pat. So thank you so much, Marlene and Pat, for putting together such a great presentation and for your time this evening, and thank you all for joining us. Have a great evening.
Thank you. It was a privilege.
Thank you.